What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Ridge.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Washington Post reporter Eric Lischblau, best-selling author of The Nazis Next Door, How America Became a Safe Haven for Hitler's Men. We'll also have a visit from our Too Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our Mevina on Israel, Oshrat Borel. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. You know, negotiation gets a bad rap these days. Many people see the give and take necessary to reach consensus as a kind of moral compromise, a sacrifice of ideals on the false idol altar of base pragmatism. Compromise? Consensus? Agreement? Not words we've heard much this past election cycle, when you couldn't turn on your computer without an ad popping up claiming a candidate had no moral foundation because he or she had compromised something in the past. Everyone seems intent on proving that they are truly principled and the people they oppose are not. But principled, well, by that they mean that they never compromise in order to achieve a political goal. Immigration reform? It might not ever get accomplished, but by golly, our elected leaders can prove they never compromised an iota in their principles. Improvements in the way we support our schools or help our children flourish? These never seem to get passed, but the people who don't pass productive measures assure us that they never change their rhetoric or political positions in any way. Serious efforts to improve our damaged and overloaded mental health system? While these might not actually ever happen, the legislators involved can definitely show that they never made any deals that diminished their ability to complain about the other side. But real progress in this world is mostly the result of masa'u matan, as we say in Hebrew, the horse trading and log rolling that allows society to solve problems and attain new and important accomplishments. Where difference of opinion exists, and it always does, reasonable negotiation will eventually lead to productive resolution. Simply saying no to everything the other side proposes leads nowhere. Agreement requires flexibility, and the Torah teaches that lesson in several ways that have great relevance today. The book of Genesis, which we're reading in Temple right now, is filled with negotiations that had great influence on the future of the fledgling religion someday to be known as Judaism. There are extended discussions, negotiations, even arguments between God and Abraham, Abraham and Sarah, between Eliezer and Laban and Rebekah, between Jacob and Esau, between Jacob and Laban, between Leah and Rachel, between Jacob and his sons, between Joseph's brothers. Virtually every story and every patriarch and matriarch and many ancillary characters are involved in important negotiations that affect the future of our people. In one Torah portion alone that we read about a week ago, Chaye Sarah, there were several negotiations that had great impact on everything that followed. The first involves Abraham purchasing the cave of Machpelah at Hebron, the first piece of real estate owned by our people in what would eventually be known as the Land of Israel. That cave becomes the burial place not only for Sarah, but for most of the patriarchs and matriarchs. Abraham, Sarah, Isaac, Rebekah, Jacob, and Leah all find their final resting place in Hebron. The purchase of that plot involved an elaborate bargaining session with a Hittite who owned it, and the payment of a huge sum for the first permanently Jewish land in the world, establishing Jewish legitimacy forever in the Middle East at a very early time in history. I once visited the Cave of Machpelah many years ago when it was still safe to travel to Hebron. It's an interesting shrine filled with candles and smoke, a little bit spooky. Following the Cave of Machpelah negotiation, there's one last important detailed episode of Abraham's life in that portion. Abraham's old. He sees that his son Isaac has not married and seems unlikely to do so without parental intervention. Abraham charges his trusted servant to go back to the old country of Sumeria, today's Iraq, and bring back a suitable girl for Isaac to marry and so to carry on the line of believers in the one true God. The servant goes on a great journey to Sumeria from Canaan. Once there, Rebekah appears in Haran. The servant knows that she is the one for Isaac because she shows instinctive generosity and obvious intelligence. The servant, too, bargains, in this case with Rebekah's duplicitous brother and father. Eventually, they negotiate for her to become Isaac's wife. And then at this crucial moment, there's one final negotiation. Rebekah's family puts the question directly to her. Will you go with this man? That is, will she leave all she's known and journey to an unknown land and future husband? Rebekah agrees. Yes, she will leave the homeland and her father's house and go to the land that will be shown to her, as Abraham, her future father-in-law, in his own way, had done before her. And she goes and meets Isaac, and the future of the people and monotheism is assured. These three negotiations revolve around crucial elements in our people's history. Land, descendants, destiny. Without title to the land of Israel, we would have remained homeless wanderers. Without descendants, we would have simply ceased to be. And without the courageous choice of women and men, like Rebekah and Abraham before her, our destiny would have been disappearance. As Jews, these remain our principal goals today, and often they still require negotiation to achieve. A secure land of Israel, our children's commitment to Judaism, and the destiny of our people as a moral light to the nations. But aren't all those good causes worth negotiating for? Weren't we better because we negotiated? May our leaders today, in this country and in Israel, come to realize that negotiation, compromise, and cooperative agreement are needed for us to succeed. And may they negotiate, as our ancestors did, with an eye always to the best possible future for everyone. Cooperation and accomplishment in democratic society can only be achieved through compromise. To play us in this morning, it's no compromise, as the commencement of our pre-Hanukkah musical preview of the Holiday of Lights, Dreidels, Latkes, and Presents, here's the Bare Naked Ladies version of the Hanukkah classic, O Hanukkah.
Oh, Hanukkah, oh, Hanukkah, come light the menorah. Let's have a party, we'll all dance the whore. Gather round the table, we'll give you a treat. A simply fun to play with and latkes to eat. And while we are playing, the candles are burning low. One for each night they shed a sweet light to remind us of days long ago. One for each night they shed a sweet light to remind us of days long ago.
Hanukkah, oh Hanukkah, come light the menorah. Let's have a party, we'll all dance the horror. Gather round the table, we'll give you a treat. A semi fun to play with and latkes to eat.
And while we are playing, the candles are burning low. One for each night they share a sweet light to remind us of days long ago. One for each night they share a sweet light to remind us of days long ago. Hanukkah, oh Hanukkah, come light the menorah. Let's have a party for love and the horror. Gather at the table, we'll give you a treat. A simply fun to play with and latkes to eat. And while we are playing, the candles are burning low. One for each night they share a sweet light to remind us of days long ago. One for each night they share a sweet light to remind us of days long ago. One for each night they share a sweet light to remind us of days long ago.
That was the Bare Naked Ladies. That's a rock group for those of you uninitiated into the great band that gave us If I Had $1 Million in 1 Week and the theme song from the Big Bang Theory TV show, singing Hanukkah, Oh Hanukkah. By the way, often people have trouble pronouncing the word Hanukkah. Actually, it's very easy. Just use your throat and say Ch, then attach it to the rest of the word, Hanukkah. It is not pronounced Hanukkah, no matter what Adam Sandler says. More seriously, the complicity of our own American government in bringing Nazi war criminals to the U.S. after World War II has become apparent. Over 10,000 proven Nazis, many actively involved in concentration camps and Hitler's final solution, were brought here after we defeated the Germans. Some of the Nazis were rocket scientists and part of the Cold War against the Soviet Union, but others were something else. Find out what when we come back with author Eric Lichtblau in a few moments here on Too Jewish. We welcome John Ben Asher, head of school for Tucson Hebrew Academy. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Rabbi Kohan.
Tell us about THA.
THA is an incredible school, rich community, strong educational culture. We're a K-8 program and Tucson's only Jewish day school.
With small classes, really a tremendous level of individual attention.
Absolutely. Our engaging, talented faculty ensure a rigorous, interactive, supporting learning environment for kids.
And those kids go on to succeed academically. This isn't just about Jewish identity.
THA graduates go on to Tucson's best high schools, and they are exceptionally well prepared.
And I've seen some of them go to Ivy League schools, some of the best colleges in the country too, if that's important for parents, which I believe it is.
That's right. THA really paves the way for students. A rich, strong academic foundation, as well as Jewish knowledge, learning, and culture.
And great community. How can people find out more about putting their kids in THA?
You can come visit or find us online, thaaz.org, and give us a call, 529-3888.
That's 529-3888, or visit www.thaaz.org.
If you like fun and games, you'll love this. And this. And even this. Casino del Sol Resort offers more fun under the sun with the newest slots, the best entertainment, and world-class golf. If you want fun, hit the at Casino del Sol Resort in Tucson. Take I-10 East to I-19 exit Valencia West or visit CasinoDelSolResort.com.
Well, they're out there having fun in that warm Arizona sun.
Enterprise of the Pasquagaki Tribe.
We are delighted to welcome the Two Jewish. Our guest this morning, author Eric Lichtblau, is an investigative reporter in the Washington Bureau of the New York Times. He writes about national security, money and politics, law enforcement, and a range of other national issues, and now about Nazis in America. He joined the New York Times originally in 2002 after spending many years as an investigative and legal affairs reporter at my home paper, the Los Angeles Times. He has won more than a dozen awards, including the 2006 Pulitzer Prize. Good morning and welcome.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm well, thanks. You wrote The Nazis Next Door, How America Became a Safe Haven for Hitler's Men. Most of us vaguely remember O. Wernher von Braun and the rocket program. But we really have no idea the scope of this. Can you tell us what led you into it?
Yeah, I think your sense of that is right, that most people, if they know anything at all about Nazis in America, they vaguely know of Wernher von Braun, who, you know, did something for Germany. And a few people might be able to tell you about a big case in the 80s and 90s involving some auto worker in Ohio, John Demjanjuk,
right?
Demjanjuk, although most people couldn't tell you his name. But the you know, the real story goes far, far beyond those one or two figures. What my research indicates based on documents and many interviews I've done with scholars in this area, you know, is that there were thousands of Nazis and active Nazi collaborators who came into America after the war, you know, as many as perhaps 10,000 or more. And they were not only scientists like Wernher von Braun, but many of them worked inside the United States or outside the United States for U.S. intelligence agencies as spies or informants, and thousands more just sort of faded into the woodwork under disguised identities and lived out their lives for the most part without any scrutiny or fear of exposure.
Why did we bring so many Nazis to the United States?
Well, I mean, with the scientists, there's a clear answer. It's not an answer that satisfies many people, but the answer is the Cold War. And in the case of the Wernher von Braun types, we brought about 1,600 scientists over from Germany under what was at first a secret program in beginning in late 1945, early 1946, called Paperclip. And that was a program that was designed to basically keep pace with the Soviet technology, especially in space and rocket exploration. But also in, we also brought over doctors. This wasn't just rocketeers. There were space aviation doctors. There were about 40 of them based in San Antonio. Supposedly, the official policy under first Truman and then Eisenhower was that these could not be "quote unquote" ardent Nazis, whatever you make of that term. but many of them, in fact, were. Von Braun oversaw rocket production at a horrible mountain factory built into the side of a mountain at a place called Dora Middelwerk, where thousands of slave laborers, for the most part not Jews, for the most part French POWs, Poles, Russian POWs, others, were often literally worked to death building the rockets for von Braun and Hitler. And the more rockets Hitler demanded for launching over London and Antwerp, the more workers were brought in with at von Braun's directive, and the more died. They were sleeping and eating and living in the most decrepit conditions you can imagine, with disease and malnutrition and exhaustion. Thousands of them died of, I don't want to call them natural causes, because those are unnatural.
Well, yeah,
events,
starving somebody to death isn't exactly natural causes.
Yes, I mean, that's not, but right. Thousands died that way, but then a smaller number even died when they, or were killed, more accurately, when they didn't meet their quota on the assembly line, or were found, some of them tried to sabotage the assembly parts of the rockets, a bold act. And they were punished by being brought to one of the huge construction cranes inside the mountain, and all the workers would be gathered around to watch, and they were hanged.
Yeah.
So this is the assembly line where Wernher von Braun and the others built their rockets. Mm. And dozens and dozens of rocketeers who were connected to that facility came to America, along with doctors and other technological experts. And the idea that, these were not people who were directly involved in Nazi atrocities is
preposterous.
I think sort of absurd, yes.
We will talk much more with Eric Lichblau about the Nazis who were brought to America when we come back in just a few moments on Too Jewish.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
We welcome David and Pam of Freedom Smoke. Tell us about your product, Freedom Smoke.
Hello, Rabbi Kohan. A pleasure to be here again. Electronic cigarette industry has been around for years. Our product, one of the best things that we've done to improve it, is the base ingredients for our product are brought in from outside of this country. The only place in the world certified kosher.
Kosher, smokeless, no tobacco, and a variety of health advantages. Do you have a lot of former smokers that have kind of quit because of Freedom Smoke?
Absolutely. We have several people who have written to us as well as told us on a personal basis.
How many flavors are there of what you sell?
Over 700.
And when people walk in the store and they don't know what to do, what do you tell them?
We start them off by finding out what they smoke and how much they smoke. We then set them up with the nicotine level that's appropriate for them, and we find the correct flavor, and that's all that it takes.
How do people find your stores?
They can find us on the internet, of course, freedomsmokeusa.com. We have a toll-free number, 800-705-7013. word of mouth is really good for our company, bringing people into our stores.
And it's kosher.
That's correct. Yep.
We'll talk next week.
Thank you.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com, TOO Jewish Radio 18@gmail.com, or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can stream all past and present shows through the website or download us from there or at the Apple iTunes Store's very popular podcasts. We continue with our pre-Hanukkah preview of music for the coming Festival of Lights with American folk singer Woody Guthrie's Hanukkah Dance, as recorded by the Klezmatics a couple of years ago. Klezmatics performing Woody Guthrie's Happy Joyous Hanukkah for the Festival of Dedication and Lights, beginning December 16th, about 3 weeks from now. This week, we celebrate Thanksgiving. I'll explain why this quintessential American holiday is actually Jewish and closely related to Hanukkah. First, any holiday where you get together with your entire family and overeat must, by definition, be Jewish. Next, historians tell us that our pilgrim forefathers based Thanksgiving on the Jewish biblical celebration of Sukkot, the harvest feast of booths or tabernacles. The Mayflower Puritans studied Hebrew with a Sephardic rabbi in Leiden, Holland before sailing for Massachusetts. When they decided to thank God for their first harvest in Plymouth, they modeled that festival on Sukkot. Interestingly, Hanukkah, which begins December 16th, is also based on Sukkot. When the Maccabees recaptured the temple in Jerusalem, cleansed it, and rededicated it, they held an 8-day festival of Thanksgiving, based on the pilgrimage festival they'd been unable to celebrate while the Syrian Greeks controlled Jerusalem and the Temple Mount. So they celebrated Sukkot late that year. The practice caught on, and it became our holiday of Hanukkah. So enjoy your turkey this week, and while you're at it, give a prayer of thanksgiving to the one God who gave us the wisdom to celebrate three of these wonderful festivals of gratitude. We welcome our Mivinan, Israel Oshrat Barel, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Oshrat.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
And again, you brought Shira, your daughter, so it's great to have you here, Shira. Shalom.
No,
shalom. Okay. It's Thanksgiving this week, but it's also a very important holiday or anniversary, I should say, for Israelis and for people who believe in Zionism all around the world. This coming weekend is actually an important anniversary. Can you tell us about it?
Yeah, it's actually the Kaftet B'November.
29th of November.
Yeah, and as you can hear, it's a mix of Kaftet season in Hebrew and November. It's like a...
English?
Yeah, but that's how we said, Kaftet B'November. It's the 29th of November. It was the declaration of Israel at the UN, which is the legal base for all the partition or all the peace agreements since then. It make it very clear that the Jewish people, the declaration at the UN made it very clear that the Jewish people have the historical, not just emotional, but historical right and to build their Jewish nation, Jewish state in Israel. And it's very
the legal
important.
Basis for the state of Israel, actually.
Yes.
The first country ever created by the UN and the only one until just a couple of years ago when they created another
one. Yes, so it's more than Tanakh and more than Avraham Avinu and more than, you know, what we feel.
It's not just the Bible. It's not just Abraham, our ancestor, and God's promise. It's a legal international agreement.
Because the UN are not like Philitachi, as you know. So they based their declaration based on historical roots, and it's very important, very very important date for us, for the Israelis and for the Jewish people. So since then we are indicating this date every year, of course. And this year, like the Israel Center, the Weintraub Israel Center, doing this at the first time, it will be at the Tucson Hebrew Academy. We are having a huge celebration, acting out
the events of the decoration.
Yeah, with all the kids and the voting and flags and
so the kids
will understand the importance of this day.
Yes. You know, it's pretty amazing because if you get an Israeli or even an American Jew or a Jew from around the world of a certain age, they remember where they were when the UN declaration, and they listened on the radio to the vote, which was, it was broadcast live, as to which country would put Israel over the top and create a Jewish state for the first time, you know, since Roman times. It's a remarkable memory, and it's kind of like our 4th of July, if you think about it, the real declaration, which didn't necessarily mean the state was officially able to sustain itself yet, but it meant there was a legal basis for Israel. Well, fantastic extra event, because we need another Jewish holiday.
Yes, but in this day, you don't need to go to the shul.
Right, you don't have to go to temple. Well, that doesn't, for me, necessarily a good thing. Thanks, Oshrat.
Thank you.
We will talk next week. Thank you, Shira. Bye-bye. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Well, there's a bit of a mess in the Middle East, which you could pretty much say always. Tell us a little bit about what's the difference between ISIS. Why is it called ISIL sometimes? Is this the new boogeyman? What's going on?
Well, first of all, when you talk about a bit of a mess in the Middle East, it reminds me always of Churchill's famous comment about the Balkans, which is they've always produced more history than they could consume. And that's true in spades of the Middle East. I mean, at one point, not too long after World War II, when Churchill was still prime minister, he said, "We ought to give the whole damn region back to the Turks and let them worry about it." It's always been a trouble spot for whoever was ruling it. And now it's a trouble spot for locals who are trying to rule it. There are hardly any states there that are genuine states and that are directed by a consensus. That may be truer and truer in today's world as we're all more connected to the internet and all that. It seems that a consensus on national identity and national dreams is rapidly disappearing from a lot of countries, including Western countries. It's certainly one way to interpret the results of our recent elections.
Sure. You know, it's funny when I think about non-failed states in the Middle East, I get to Israel and then I start to struggle.
Yeah, but even Israel is highly polarized and often engaged in political gridlock and unable to make courageous decisions. You heard about this recent letter from former army commanders and high-level generals telling Netanyahu to show some leadership, show some backbone, show some imagination, and finally make peace.
Right, which seems to be, they're in consensus with the White House at the moment. ISIS is an extreme Islamist group that seems to have spun out of the Syrian civil war and headed for Iraq. Is that an incorrect assumption?
I think it's mostly in Iraq, and it controls a great deal of northern Iraq right now. And the Iraqi government, in order to maintain any semblance of legitimacy, has to retake territory that it has lost to this peristatal thing. And, you know, part of the problem is, so people ask me all the time, like, what should we be doing about ISIS? How do we confront this? And the fact is, we as a country have a very poor track record of dealing with non-state entities. We've made war on poverty, on homelessness, on hunger, on Islamic fundamentalists, on terrorism, et cetera, et cetera. And we've never won any of those wars, because the wars that we know how to fight, the wars that we're set up for in sort of the Army War College in West Point and the Naval Academy in Annapolis and all of that.
Air Force Academy, everything.
Right. All of those institutions of learning and all of our war-making instruments are geared to fighting enemies that are a state or controlled by a state. And when it comes to any non-state combatant, we seem to lose our way very quickly. And a classic example of that is the Vietnam War, where there was a guerrilla movement, which against all odds ended up defeating us because we were not fighting a state entity. We were fighting a popular guerrilla movement.
Well, let's talk about what we might be able to do next week. Thanks, Tom.
I look forward to it.
When we come back here on Too Jewish, we'll hear the old Jewish joke of the week. You can help send kids to our community's Jewish schools without it costing you a dime. Direct your state tax dollars instead to JETCO, the Jewish Education Tax Credit Organization. The state allows its taxpayers to receive a dollar-for-dollar tax credit, not just a deduction, for payments made to recognized school tuition organizations, who then provide scholarships for kids in kindergarten through 12th grade who go to qualified private schools. JETCO provides quality Jewish education to children in need at Temple Emmanuel Kindergarten, Congregation Anshe Israel Kindergarten, Tucson JCC Kindergarten, and the Tucson Hebrew Academy. If you pay Arizona state income taxes, make your contribution to JETCO, you'll receive 100% tax credit on your state income tax return. Tax credit, not a deduction. There's an additional tax credit, the switcher credit this year. You can go up to $1,031 to JETCO for a single filer, $2,062 for married couples filing jointly. When we need every dollar we can for Jewish education, this is the time to make a contribution to JETCO. Do so by calling 647-8442, that's 647-8442, or visit JETCO on the web, jetco.org. Give the gift of education.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Two Jewish guys are sitting in a deli in a Jewish neighborhood, talking amongst themselves in Yiddish. An obviously Chinese waiter comes up and in fluent and impeccable Yiddish asks them, is everything okay? Can he get them anything? The Jewish guys are dumbfounded. After he leaves, they say, my God, where did he learn such perfect Yiddish? They pay the bill and they call the deli owner over to the table. Where did your Chinese waiter learn such fabulous Yiddish? They ask him. The owner leans in so nobody can hear and says, shh, he thinks we're teaching him English. That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. Now a word of Torah. The urge to journey out into the unknown is a major motivation in the Torah. We saw it with Abraham a few weeks ago. We'll find it in the lives of most of our ancestors, and we encounter it most powerfully in the story of this week's great Torah portion of Vayetze. At the start of the tale, our ancestor Jacob leaves his family and his home, both of which are in Beersheba in the southern part of Canaan, and journeys towards Sumeria, today's Iraq. Jacob has nothing with him at all, not even a bedroll, and is forced to lay his head on a rock to sleep. In his state of extremis, God brings a promise in the form of a famous dream, a ladder going up to heaven with angels ascending and descending, a pledge of family, land, and ultimate safety and security. Jacob wakes from his dream and says pointedly, "Hey, God was in this place, and I didn't know it." That's something all of us can say from time to time, isn't it? Somehow, Jacob must first leave everything familiar to allow him to find God's presence. Throughout human history, religions have been founded by men who left ordinary lives and average places and wandered off into the wilderness, usually the desert. Abraham, Jacob, and Moses are the Jewish pioneers like this. Buddha, Jesus, and Muhammad fit the same pattern.
To become who we seek to be, we must begin by leaving what we already know. Of course, when we finally encounter God in the wilderness, we learn that God was back there too, at home. We just weren't yet ready to notice that. Of all the heroic figures in our people's past, Jacob might be the most interesting. He's complex, clever, unreliable, resourceful, and he has a rather spectacularly complicated love life, which takes off in this week's portion of Vayetse. But it's that first moment when he realizes how little he really knows that makes him appear most human, most like us. We too struggle to figure out just where we can find God. If we're lucky and aware, we too come to realize that God is in this place, indeed, in every place. All we have to do is open our eyes to see that. The U.S. government brought about 10,000 Nazis to America after the end of World War II. Why did we import so many of our arch enemies and some perpetrators of the worst crimes against humanity in all of human history? The answers may shock you. Find out from our guest, author Eric Lischblau, when we return in a few moments here on Too Jewish.
If you like fun and games, you'll love this. And this. And even this. Casino del Sol Resort offers more fun under the sun with the newest slots, the best entertainment, and world-class golf. If you want fun, hit the at Casino del Sol Resort in Tucson. Take I-10 East to I-19 exit Valencia West or visit CasinoDelSolResort.com.
Well, they're out there having fun in that warm Arizona sun.
Enterprise of the Pasquayaki Tribe.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Last week in Jerusalem, two Palestinian Arab terrorists brutally murdered four prominent rabbis and scholars as they prayed the morning service, Shacharit, in a synagogue in the holy city. In this burgeoning third intifada, we now have experienced a Palestinian Arab terror attack that should provoke universal horror. And yet, somehow it doesn't. In the western Jerusalem neighborhood of Har Nof, there's a shul frequented by some of the finest scholars of Talmud in a city filled with them. That sacred space was invaded by two Palestinian Arab terrorists with machetes, knives, and pistols. They murdered five people, four older scholars and one brave 30-year-old policeman, and wounded seven other unarmed people before police shot the murderers dead. Kehilat B'nai Torah Synagogue is on Agassi Street, a Lithuanian synagogue, in a courtyard that includes a yeshiva for married men, a kollel, and another synagogue. The 6:30 a.m. Shacharis Minyan included dozens of worshipers. The chairman of the organization that oversees recovering bodies from terror attacks, Zaka head Yehuda Meshi Zahav, described the scene inside the synagogue after the Palestinian terror attack. "I've seen disaster scenes that were a lot worse, with more fatalities, but to see Jews with beards and payas wrapped in tefillin, surrounded by puddles of blood, I do not remember seeing such a sight." "This is not a cliche, it's reality," he continued. "We have only seen things like this happen in the Holocaust." Among the murdered men was Rabbi Moshe Tursky, 59 years old, the head of the English-speaking Yeshiva Toras Moshe in Jerusalem, and a prominent member of one of the most important Orthodox families in the world. The policeman who died was a sergeant, an Israeli Druze man from a village in the Galilee. Rabbi Benjamin Blech, an author and professor at Yeshiva University, wrote movingly about it. He said, "Death is a misfortune. Murder is far more horrible to bear. Turned into a massacre, it shocks us into unmitigated grief." But there was still more to the terrorist attack this week in Israel. It happened in the holy city of Jerusalem, a place in which we are meant to feel the nearness of God. It took place in a synagogue attended by early morning worshipers who came only to stand in the presence of the Almighty and worship the Creator of the universe. It was carried out by those who brought axes, knives, and weapons of violence into the house of God. The victims were in the midst of the silent prayer, reverently reciting words that dream of peace, as well as the hope for a messianic time when all people dwell together in brotherhood and tranquility. They wore tefillin, signs of God's closeness to our hands and our minds. Garbed in their prayer shawls, they were brutally executed by those for whom their very holiness proved provocative. Could there be anything more horrible than this? And then Blech went on to say that actually there was, namely, the response of Palestinian leader Mahmoud Abbas, whose name rarely appears in the media without the prefix moderate, who gave the pro forma required regrets to the English-speaking world, while at the same time in Arabic to his own people, praising those who carried out the violence against Jews that he has been loudly agitating for these past months. Abbas, Abu Mazen, also demanded an end to the Israeli provocations that he made clear are the cause of all Palestinian murders. Just a few days ago, he warned that he and fellow Palestinians would not allow Jews to contaminate the Temple Mount, adding that allowing Jewish prayer at the site would result in global religious war. For the moderate Abbas, Jews dare not pray on the Temple Mount, or apparently for that matter, in any synagogue, with hope for safety and survival. And as soon as these rabbis were massacred at prayer in their synagogue in Jerusalem, the famous Arab street began to joyously pass out sweets to their children and offer praise for the glorious martyrs who carried out the gruesome bloodbath. Murder of innocents needs no justification. When the victims are Jews, it is a time for rejoicing by Arabs everywhere. Finally, there was the response from the mainstream media to the fact that two Palestinian Arab terrorists invaded a synagogue with axes, knives, and guns and brutally attacked a group of people who were praying. It was more of the balanced reporting we got used to when Israel struggled to defend itself this past summer against rocket attacks shot into civilian areas all around the country. The BBC led the news of this murder with the headline, "Jerusalem Police Fatally Shoot Two After Apparent Synagogue Attack." The four murdered rabbis were not worth mentioning to the BBC anyway, but the terrorists who slaughtered innocents were. CNN might have been worse. It began by calling the terrorist outrage an attack on a mosque, which didn't correct for hours. It was, of course, an attack on a shul. Their headline was, "Four Israelis, two Palestinians killed in synagogue attack, Israeli police say," as though the two Palestinians were the victims in the attack, not the Arab terrorist Palestinian murderers that they were, giving moral equivalence somehow to the terrorists and their victims. A very, very sad incident, a clear indication that the Third Intifada is underway, that so-called moderate Palestinians have again embraced terror and death. Sad and very sick. And right here in Tucson, Arizona, where I live, in a story that has hit the national news wire, SAE fraternity at the University of Arizona is now on interim suspension after attacking members of the Jewish fraternity, AE Pi, a week ago Friday night. About 15 members of the Sigma Alpha Epsilon fraternity forced their way into the apartment of a member of AE Pi, shouting anti-Semitic discriminatory comments at the students and physically assaulting them, according to the Dean of Students. The president of the University of Arizona AE Pi chapter said it was not the first time they'd been victims of an attack. There was one last year that left the then president with a serious concussion. Members of the suspended SAE fraternity have been prohibited from having any contact with members of AE Pi. Police are not currently investigating the incident as a hate crime, at least not yet. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews Around the World. We are delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning. Eric Lischblau is an investigative reporter at the Washington Bureau of the New York Times, where he has written for many years. Prior to that, he was at the LA Times. He has won more than a dozen awards for his journalism, including the 2006 Pulitzer Prize for national reporting, breaking the story of the secret wiretapping program that President Bush authorized after 9/11. His new book is called The Nazis Next Door, How America Became a Safe Haven for Hitler's Men, which is an extraordinary expansion of our knowledge about all of these programs. We talked earlier about Wernher von Braun and all the rocketeers who were brought over. I remember Tom Lehrer singing about von Braun in the early 60s. 60s. You know, once rockets go up, who cares? Well, they come down.
Von Braun was really a legend. I mean, he was a folk hero in many ways. He had his own show on Disney. He was this dynamic, almost larger-than-life personality. I mean, he was not only, obviously, a brilliant engineer, but he played classical piano. He scuba dove. He was, you know, this handsome, dynamic man, and he was a legend in the 50s and 60s.
By golly, a member of the master race, huh? So,
hadn't thought about that.
Yeah. So, but Von Braun, the justification for the Cold War work that the rocket guys did, oh, we have them and the Soviets don't. How does that extend to the more than 8,000 other Nazis who were brought to the United States?
Right. Well, a smaller number, about 1,000 by my count, were used as spies by the United States, not just in the United States, but in Europe and the Middle East and Latin America and Australia. And to my mind, this is the most insidious group of all. You can make the case that somehow that the scientists, the Wernher von Braun types, you know, brought some clear technological benefits to the United States. We might not have gotten to the moon. They had the Soviets in 1969 without them. And, you know, a little Nazi baggage, you know, well, we'll put up with that. I don't happen to subscribe to that view. But with the Nazi spies, this other group of informants and spies and intelligence assets, really, they brought nothing of value. These were guys who were SS officers, who sometimes were concentration camp wardens, there was one guy who was a top aide, Adolf Eichmann, believe it or not, who then went on to become spies for the CIA, usually starting in Europe, but in some cases they then came over to the United States with the help of the CIA. The CIA would help to cleanse their records, would denazify their files, and help them get through immigration, as in a couple of cases is what they described in the CIA's own files as a reward. That's their word, not mine, a reward for their spy work. In the case of the Eichmann aide, he was a guy named Otto von Bolschwing. He worked as a spy in Europe in the 50s after working with the Nazis during the war, obviously, and he was not a very good spy. I tell the story in the book of how he, on a train in Austria in 1953, lost a suitcase filled with top secret photos and documents that identified another agent, and he got his bag mixed up with someone else's bag.
Oh my God!
And he got to the end of the line and realized that instead of spy photos, there were pajamas and a toilet kit inside. And the CIA, in the file that I examined, he was accused of sheer foolhardiness, and they thanked their lucky stars that they eventually, through blind luck, got that suitcase, got the original documents back. Now, if that were you or I, who not only was a top Eichmann aide, but then, you know, losing spy documents, we probably would have been fired from the CIA. Not only wasn't he fired, he kept his job, and they helped move him to New York in the mid-1950s with his wife and child, and he lived for 25 years without any scrutiny at all. And I, you know, the moral depravity is really stunning. They said in his case that they were bringing him to the United States as a reward for his, again, that's their word, a reward for his loyal CIA service in Europe in the 50s. And in view of his, quote, the quote, innocuousness of his Nazi party activities. Now, he's a fascinating character, and I spend a lot of time in the book talking about him, which I hope you read anyway, even though I'm telling you all the highlights here. But
no, it's a great.
What happened with von Bolschwing was that his old boss Adolf Eichmann, as I'm sure you recall, was captured
by the Mossad in Argentina.
Yeah, in 1960, this bold, brash operation, and you know, when it was taken back to Israel, one of the most famous trials in 20th century history, and for Otto von Bolschwing, this was a terrifying moment. he feared, quite correctly, that his name was going to come out at the trial. In fact, Eichmann did name him, as almost credited him as a pioneer of the early policies in the late 1930s to terrorize the Jews, sort of before they were all, before the concentration camps were set up in big numbers. Well, von Bolschwing was terrified that the Israelis were going to come after him next. So what did he do? He goes back to the CIA for help. And the CIA protected him. They didn't tell the Israelis who he was or where he was. He was living at that point in New York City. He was a successful businessman. They didn't tell their own U.S. Justice Department or immigration officials. And it was then another 20 years that he lived out his life before anyone realized who he was, anyone besides the CIA.
You know, it's stunning. Even for those of us who understand that government is often real politic, that it's trying to do, you know, whatever its current goal is, and it doesn't always care about anything having to do with the past, this reaches a new level of stunning amorality.
It does, when, yeah. The spies especially, I find just the most morally repugnant of the group, because they brought nothing of value. You know, in some cases, von Bolschwing's not even the worst of the lot in terms of spies.
They weren't even good spies.
He was a bad spy. There were actually some Nazi spies who turned out to be Soviet double agents. So they weren't just bad spies. They were damaging spies. And of course, I think for most people, the morality does matter. We don't want to, put the morality aside and just sort of weigh things in terms of their, you know, Cold War efficacy or what have you. The morality should play a part. And, you know, it clearly didn't. I mean, I examined CIA documents in the cases of other spies where, you know, they would do the polygraphs. They would wire the guys up to talk about their records, their pasts, to basically tell whether they were to determine their truthfulness to the CIA as spies. And they would openly say to them, you know, don't worry about any moral lapses in your past with the Nazis. We're not here to talk about that. And in the case of one spy in the middle, a Nazi SS officer went on to work for the CIA in the Middle East, they concluded that he was probably guilty of, quote, minor war crimes, end quote, for the Nazis during the war. And you know, I found that such a jarring phrase that I name a chapter, I call the chapter Minor War Crimes. That's such a such a jarring juxtaposition. Not major war crimes, only minor ones.
What qualified as a minor war crime precisely?
Well, he was a troop leader for the SS. He had admitted in some of his interviews that he may have led a Nazi execution squad, things like that.
Just little killings.
Little things, right. He wasn't an Eichmann aide, but other things. So, yeah. But, there's the whole third group, which you're asking about, the numbers, the 10,000 numbers. You know, the third group really had sort of came in through the back door without any help, unlike the scientists, unlike the spies. You know, they were here, as far as we know, without the direct knowledge of the U.S. government. But it wasn't easy for them to it wasn't hard for them to disguise their past. They basically just got in by claiming to be people they weren't or disguising their true roles in Nazi Germany. These were people who were, concentration camp guards, concentration camp wardens, police officials in Eastern Europe who were in charge of interrogating Jews or rounding up Jews or turning them over to the Gestapo. But when it came time to apply to the United States for visas in the late 40s and the early 50s, especially when there were enormous numbers of visas available for Eastern European immigrants, they simply claimed to be farmers or civilians in the government or POWs even. And so you had this massive influx of Eastern European immigrants at the same time, ironically, as there were very few visas available for the Holocaust survivors themselves. It was very tough for them to get in, and yet there were 400,000 visas available from Eastern Europe, because those were people who were seen as good stock, was the phrase that was used. And these were also people who were about to fall into Soviet hands under the Soviet rule, and we wanted them in the United States. We didn't want the communists to have them. We wanted them.
It's an amazing story. Not one that will make you feel good about the way the U.S. government did its business.
It really doesn't, yeah. It's infuriating, yeah.
Yeah, it's stunning. I mean, considering the Great War against the Nazis, how many Americans lost their lives to fight the Nazis, and then to welcome, you know, these were not reconstructed Nazis. Reminds me of Patton's statement that they should hire the Nazis to be the mayors of the towns once they captured them, because they knew how to run things.
Right, exactly.
The book is called The Nazis Next Door, How America Became a Safe Haven for Hitler's Men. It's a terrific book. I want to thank Eric Lischblau for a great visit here on Two Jewish. Thank you so much, Eric.
Thank you for having me.
When we come back on Two Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical playout.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Two Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9 o'clock. Our guest will be comedian Joel Chasnoff, a Jewish day school graduate and very funny man. Our playout this morning is from our recent guest, the wonderful violinist Vadim Gluzman, soon to be featured December 5th, 6th, and 7th with the Tucson Symphony at Music Hall and the Symphony Center. My friends, may you have a Shavua Tov, a wonderful Thanksgiving of gratitude to God. A good week and a week, we pray, of peace.